The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So this notion that the Buddha, there's a notion that the Buddha, what he practices is called the middle practice, the practice that's in the middle. And it's a very rich concept in Buddhism, the idea of the middle. And it appears a number of ways. One way, that the most famous way, is something called the middle way. The word translated as way literally means practice. So the middle practice, the middle way. And also there's that idea that the Buddha teaches. When he teaches by means of the middle, whatever that means. And there's a third place, very important place, where this idea of middle appears. And this is where I want to start today, is a very long, seemingly somewhat long, Pali word, ancient language, which is just a compound of three very ordinary words. And the three ordinary words is a word that means something like all this here. That's the first word, tatra. The second one is majja, which is middle. And the third means tata, which means to stand. To stand in the middle of all this. So this idea of in the middle of this world, in the middle of our life, to be able to stand strong, upright, with some strength and stability, where we don't lean forward into the world and we don't pull back. When I was a Zen student many years ago, I asked the Zen abbot, Zen teacher, because in Zen what they do is at some point you get ordained as a priest, and then at some point you receive what's called Dharma transmission, and that's when you can be a full teacher, like something is transmitted to you. And I asked this abbot, what does it mean to be a Dharma transmitted in Zen? And he said, that's when you can stand on your own two feet. And so this idea that now you can take care of yourself. Now you can, no matter where you go, you can stand on your own two feet. Another Zen teacher, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, Shinryo Suzuki Roshi, said something, someone asked him something like, what do you have trust or what do you have faith in? And he said, I have trust in my butt on my cushion and my feet on the ground when you're standing. And I bet the person who asked the question wasn't expecting that as the answer. But I think it's quite a fantastic answer. Again, this idea of standing in the middle of this. We have this expression, the calm in the middle of the storm, or we have this expression of standing in the middle of the fire. And it's amazing strength, to develop the strength, the capacity, the inner resiliency, the inner freedom to be able to stand in the social fires of our times, in the challenges of family life, the challenges of work life, and whatever it might be, where there's a lot of challenge, but to be able to not be pushed over by it or be crushed by it or be angry by it and be, you know, strike out because of it, but something about not leaving the situation, but also not asserting oneself, but standing strong and upright. And my imagination is that the Buddhist version of the, I think it's the Christian idea of turn the other cheek if someone hits you, something like that. And the Buddhist version of that, if someone hits you, stand there and look them in the eye. And in saying that, what I mean by that is that you don't turn the other cheek to give them another chance, but you also don't strike them and you don't leave. You just like stand there. They have to deal with you. I'm here. And we look them in the eye. Now, this doesn't mean that in every possible circumstance we're supposed to do that, because there are terrible places and dangerous situations. I once was approached by these two big people who were really angry with me on the street. They were strangers. I'd interfered with their There was a woman who was trying to get away from them. So I stood in the middle to protect her. And they were bigger than me. And I'm a little bit tall, right? But they were like, and big and strong. And like, you know, I was a thin little guy back then. And so I didn't stand there tall and straight and look them in the eye. I stayed in the middle between us, but I took a step back when they stepped towards me. And then I took a step back and they stepped toward me. Until some new other person came, and I didn't make the peace, but some other person, stranger, came by and figured out how to make peace at all. But I kind of held my ground. Kind of, I stayed in protecting the woman. I stayed in the middle, in a sense. So it's not an easy thing to do, but when I see the statue of the Buddha, you know, the night of his awakening, I see someone who has that strength, that capacity, who's developed that capacity over time. And that's one capacity that we can develop. The ability to be in the middle of our life and all the challenges of it and hold our center. And it's a center that maybe allows us to, for wisdom to operate more because we're not reacting to the situation. And maybe wisdom says, now's the time to step back. Stands tall and straight in the middle of it, but maybe 2 feet away, or maybe a block away, or something. But the idea of you don't lose your center in the middle of it. And I think a fantastic place to cultivate this is in meditation. And I feel to some degree meditation helped me a lot to cultivate this, because all kinds of I don't know how your mind is. Maybe your mind is serene and never have a distracted thought ever. But, you know, I had all these thoughts and emotions and feelings and reactions to things that weren't even happening at the time, but things that happened 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so, you know, I was buffeted around by my thoughts, the ideas, the stuff in my mind. One of the things that buffeted me around a lot when I started practicing meditation was physical pain. I had a lot of pain. And so, slowly learning how to sit with it, sit with my mind, sit with my crazy mind, sit with my burning body, and just learn how to sit balanced, centered, non-reactive. One of the things I learned to do was to recognize when I had self-pity for myself, which was a kind of way of succumbing and feeling more pain. I suffered more when I had self-pity. And I could start to, I could watch, after a while I could see, when I had self-pity, poor Gil, that everything hurt more. And I learned that if I wanted to hurt less, I should stop having self-pity. And so to sit in the middle of it all without this leaning into it or reacting to it, being not for it, not against it, not denying anything, but also not, I don't know what the opposite of denying is here, affirming anything or celebrating anything. And so, but it's not a aloofness, it's not a disinterest, it's not a detachment from it. A friend of mine talks about the middle way between detachment and attachment. The middle way. And certainly attachment is a problem. But in English, I think the word detachment generally is considered not a good thing to do. It's kind of aloof, distant, you know, uninterested, unconnected. But is there a third way? Is there a way of being neither detached nor attached? And a third way is to be awake in this way. To be awake, to be present, to be attentive to what's happening. But not buy into it, but not reject it. Is that too, does that seem like it's detached? Does it seem like it's aloof? It could be for some people might do it that way, but that's not, I think, that's not what I'm trying to point to. I'm talking about how to be in this world fully and offer a kind of calm, stable, strong presence for the things in our life that need that. I think the world needs more people who have the ability to have a strong, calm presence. And so this Tatra Majja Tata, standing in the middle of it all, it's usually translated into English as equanimity. But I suspect equanimity loses some of the power of the word, some of the strength of standing upright and strong and clear. Here I am. And it's not self-denial. Sometimes Buddhism is associated with being kind of a little bit self-effacing, kind of unattached, easygoing. And I don't know if it's, I don't know if that's what it should be. I don't think that the Buddha doesn't never seem to be easygoing exactly. But he seemed to be always calm. But he seemed to be a person who was very strong. All the depictions of him is that of someone who shows up with a certain degree of confidence and strength, but not asserting himself. So this middle way, the middle practice that the Buddha taught is the middle between indulging addiction to, or indulging in, or addiction to sensual pleasures of all kinds. And this is back in ancient India, that was kind of the epitome of someone who was living fully the lay life, the domestic life, the so-called, or the lay life, where you just partake in all the pleasures that is available to you and addicted to it. That's on one extreme. The other extreme is self-denial and asceticism. The kind of self-denial that is kind of ascetic self-denial, not eating enough and not drinking enough and not sleeping and all these kinds of things, that there was a whole school of religious people in ancient India who were doing. The Buddha did it too before he found this path to awakening. He tried some of these ascetic practices of his times. And so the Buddha says what his discovery was, what he awoke to, was a middle way, a middle practice, how to practice, how to live a life that is not indulging in comfort and comfort, creature comforts and sensual pleasures, not, but at the same time not denying them, not indulging in asceticism, but not necessarily denying that there's pain in this life. You know, back in his time, they had no, as far as I know, they had no pain medication. So a lot of the, you know, the miracles of medicine that we have, that, you know, when people had pain back then, it was, you know, there wasn't much to do about it, but live with it, work with it. So I'm sure the Buddha had pain. In fact, we know he did. He had a bad back. In case any of you have bad back, you know, you have good company. And so not indulging in asceticism, but certainly not running away from pain. Not indulging in sensual pleasure, but not running away from it either if it finds you. The middle way between, and sometimes people say between the two, because those are two extremes. And sometimes the people have this image, it's like a spectrum, and you find the balance between the two in the middle. That's the middle way. But in fact, what the middle path here implies more, the middle kind of practice, is more like a path in the forest. You know, it's not a path in the middle of the forest. It's not necessarily smack in the middle of the forest, but it's the clearing in the forest where you can walk and find your way. And so the place where there's a clearing in our minds and our hearts so that we can find our way through this complicated life of ours. And the clearing to find the way is defined, the middle way, the middle practice, is defined as the Eightfold Path. So there's all these, and they're all practices. So that's why calling it the middle way is not, you know, as I said before, it's not literally the meaning, it's the middle practice. These eight practices that we can engage in. And some of them involve a lot of pleasure, dharmic pleasure. Some of them involve something that, a word that some people consider to be asceticism, but the Buddha does not, and that is renunciation, a certain healthy form of letting go. And the renunciation that we're learning to let go of, that some people sounds like the denial, is never the things of the world. The Buddha seemingly never said let go of money or let go of things, unless you're a monastic, which is following different strategy of how to practice. But it's always the clinging, learning to let go or renounce the clinging, the grasping we have. And so to do the middle practice is the practice between clinging and rejecting things. There's no aversion to things. It's not like we're throwing things away. But the middle way is all in our minds, in our hearts, where we release the clinging there. And without the clinging, then we can take the middle way here. And the ancient texts also talk about, say that the Buddha, when he taught by the means of the middle. And so the means, what is the means by the method, the middle method kind of? And what is that? And this was the way of teaching that didn't posit that things exist in any kind of eternal, substantial, real way. At the same time, it doesn't claim that nothing exists. Things don't really exist. There's no denial of things of that arise, that exist. But there's no affirmation that these are permanent, real things at the same time. So he teaches without either one. And so like with suffering, which Buddhism is supposed to address, that's the heart of it. I've had suffering in my life where I had this clear feeling, depressive feeling, oh, this is the way it's going to be forever. This is it. This is who I am. I'm going to suffer now for the rest of my life. And then that's the delusion of permanence. And he said, no, and then I've heard people say, oh, there's no real suffering. Suffering is empty. Everything is empty. It's just a delusion that you're suffering. There's no really suffering. And that also seems, to me, that seems like a delusion. But for the Buddha, he taught by means of the middle, where he said, yes, there is suffering, but suffering is not permanent nor non-existent. Suffering is part of a process that unfolds. It's an activity and movement of the mind, processes of the mind. And because it's process, the processes can be changed. We can get in there into the mind and change those processes of our mind, reshape them, so and free them so that we can reduce and then eventually free ourselves from suffering. So the same thing with the idea of a self. The idea of, you probably, many of you who know a little bit about Buddhism, know that the Buddha, one of the big teachings of the Buddha was the idea of not self, often interpreted as meaning there is no self. If there is no self, that's kind of like the delusion, the extreme side, that there's something that doesn't exist at all. The other side, that there is a self, and the self is the real thing, and the, you know, everything else might be not real, but the self is real. That's what you have to believe in. Or my identity, or who I am, or like, psychologically, I think there's a lot of people who don't, they're not thinking about themselves philosophically, like, but functionally, the way their mind works, they just operate as if I'm a bad person, and that's the deal. that's how I am. This is what's true. It's never going to be different. I'm always bad. I'm always somehow lousy or a jerk or whatever it is, you know, fill in the blank. This is the kind of person I am. And it's like solidified and there's no idea of movement. And so the teaching by the middle is to point to an alternative to claiming some substantial unchanging self and then claiming that there is no self. There is a, whatever the self is, it's a series of processes. It's activities of the mind that come together to give us a feeling, a sense that here I am, that has some accuracy to it. If you need to pee, you should know that you're the one who needs to do it. You don't knock on your neighbor's door and ask them to do it. You know, please, you know, can you go to the bathroom because I have to pee? That's silly, right? I mean, it's ridiculous. And that's a ridiculous example. I apologize for it maybe, but there's many things like that that we have to have some sense of agency and things we're responsible for here and the presence. But it's all in flux. It's all in motion. It's all changing all the time. If I have to go pee, I'm the person in need to pee. But once I've peed, that's gone. Only to return later, maybe. But the point being that this, who we are as a self is fluid and changing. And so the Buddha taught by the means of the middle. Between that, he doesn't want to say that things exist, he doesn't want to say that things don't exist, he doesn't want to say that things are eternal, or say that they're going to disappear once and for all. He's going to say that everything is in process. And that because everything is changing and in process, then we can talk about standing in the middle of all those processes. We can find a place of stillness. We can find a place of awareness, of attention, where our attentiveness, our attention to the moment is stable. And even if you can't sit up straight because you have a bad back, that... whatever it is, it's a metaphoric uprightness. So we find the stability inside of us, in the heart, in the mind, in inner stillness, in awareness. And it's remarkable to be with someone. You can feel that there's a stillness within them. There they are. They're present, but they're still. They're present, but they're calm. They're present and here, but they're unruffled. It's kind of a gift to be with a person like that. It's a gift to be that kind of person for yourself. So in meditation, when we come back to the breathing, when we let go of the thoughts, when we let go of a reactivity, come back and sit calm, let go and relax, it's a constant kind of process of finding that center, finding that place of stability, finding that place of non-reactivity, finding that place of not being caught in the existence of things or the non-existence of things, caught in the pursuit of pleasure, which can happen in meditation if you're uncomfortable and thinking the meditation's all about kind of having bliss, and you're not caught in asceticism and kind of searching for pain in meditation, thinking that if the more pain you have, the more you're probably spiritual or something. I don't know what. But it's all something we're practicing with in the middle, standing in the middle of the fire when it's difficult, standing equally in the middle in the water, if the water represents some kind of peace and nice state. Standing in the middle. And it's my feeling, my experience, that to do that, to learn to do that, helps us become a channel for love and for care and for compassion. Because when we don't stand in the middle, in a calm, upright way, then we're preoccupied by something else. We're caught in something. And as soon as we're caught in something, ruffled by things, preoccupied by things, there's much less room for the love, the care, the compassion to be there. So I don't think it's, this statue of the Buddha, the way he's sitting. I think his eyes are not really closed. They're like a little bit open, symbolic for being in the world more and be present for what's going on in the world. But he's also not caught by the world or actively involved. But, you know, the statue is also an embodiment of a person who has great compassion together. And, you know, he spent his teaching career teaching out of his care for the world. So the middle practice, the middle way. I find that I partly wanted to teach about this today because I find it to be a very evocative metaphor. And it's kind of like the third way. So if you find yourself in challenges in your life, you might maybe have your usual ways of understanding it, but you might ask yourself, what's the middle way here? Where's the middle to be here with? What is a third way that I don't know yet? What's a third way which is the middle? To practice in the middle, to see the middle, to not get caught in either end of extremes. What is that? Where's the middle here? We're practicing the middle way, and it does. I find that it solves so many problems because even like in difficult conversations with other people, I've been in conversations where someone would say, let's look for the middle way here. And what happens in the conversations is that people start thinking a new way. The people tend not to be so locked into the way that they're arguing. It's, oh, maybe there's another way that is different than what I thought, different than what I want, but another way that maybe works for everybody here. A clearing in the forest where we can all walk. What is that way? And so I find this idea of the middle as being evocative or suggestive of new ways of thinking and as we go through our life. Where's the middle here? So those are my thoughts today. And if you have any questions or comments or testimonials about the middle or something, you can protests about it, you're welcome. We can have a little discussion for a few minutes. Or about anything, actually.
Gil, thank you so much. So I love what you said about the middle way being not necessarily the center point or the point that's equidistant in the middle of the left and the right path. But you talked about like a clearing or a way opening. So I don't really have too much of a question. I'm just wondering if you can talk more about that.
So talk more about the clearing. My strongest association I have with it is we're clearing clinging. Clinging is considered the underbrush. And so you can't get through the forest because of all the underbrush. So you want to clear away the clinging. And that's what opens up the space.
Thank you.
I understand the concept of middle way, the way you described. However, there is something you mentioned, like when you talk to somebody, you know, finding the middle and stuff. How do you find the middle with a racist person?
How do you find the middle?
The middle, if the person you are talking with is a racist. Right. So how do you find the middle?
I don't know. But maybe, just maybe, we don't call someone a racist. Or we don't call it racist. Because that maybe makes it more substantial than it needs to be. Rather, we say, ouch, that hurt. That seems to be, that seems to be putting someone down. That seems to be oppressing someone. That's limiting someone's life. That's destroying someone's life. And maybe make a comment about the process and what we're seeing, rather than a solid noun idea. And then maybe there's room for, maybe a little more room for conversation.
Okay. It's just sometimes it feels like there's no room for conversation.
Sorry?
Sometimes it feels in a certain instances like there is no room for conversation. People's minds are made up. It doesn't matter what you say. Is that totally?
Yeah. So if we're talking about, you know, political discussions around racism and different points of view of, you know, all this, some of those conversations don't have to happen, because in it isn't like we're witnessing racism right in front of us, that someone's being hurt, but there's just very strong different points of view. So one way of being in the middle is not needing to change other, someone else in that circumstance. Just, okay, well, that's what you think, I'm sorry, or something, or just become quiet. Maybe that's a middle sometimes. Or it might be that to change the subject to something that's more productive and useful to discuss about. And then eventually you might come back indirectly to this topic. You don't forget about it, but it's not going to be useful. Some of these conversations are not useful. People are not open for discussion. They're open for throwing out their opinions. Mm. One of the guidelines that the Buddha gave for conversations with people is only have the conversation if it's useful. And if some conversations are not useful because no one's going to budge their position. And so then you're kind of wasting your time.
Yeah. Thank you. That's helpful.
And then it's the idea of the third way, the middle way, might be that sometimes it's indirect. Sometimes we have a feeling we have to, you know, solve all the problems directly and attack this something terrible. And sometimes some things are better addressed indirectly. Not in the case of racism, but I've read about some man who did it indirectly. It's a black man who was a musician, a jazz musician, who was perplexed why some white people hated him without knowing who he was. So he started going to Ku Klux Klan rallies and becoming friends with the people there. And it took a while, and they'd go out for dinner, and they invited him to his house. They were friends, and after a while, because they're becoming, the first time they became friends with a black person, they realized that that they didn't know black people. They didn't know, they had all these judgments. And so he started collecting all these Ku Klux Klan robes of people who left the Klan because of him. So he wasn't arguing with anyone. He had this third way.
Okay.
Sometimes I've waited years before having a conversation with someone because I didn't see there was any opening for the conversation, and I waited and waited, and finally there was an opening, and then I could speak it. So the idea that we have to always speak up right away is not necessarily the most useful thing, belief to have.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's, I think, like with racism, it's such an important topic for this issue for this country and for the world in many ways, that we don't want to, by not speaking about it directly, we don't want to forget about it either. But we have to kind of then think cleverly, what other ways are there to work with this?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you. You made me think about the Serenity Prayer as perhaps a middle way, especially with that example you just gave, where you can't accept the things, you can't, you know, you can change, and you can't change the things you don't accept. And
yeah,
it's about having the knowledge to know the difference and sort of seeing that middle way in some sense about an awakening or an enlightenment about differentiating those, uh-huh. which are pretty difficult often, but kind of the goal of that serenity prayer, right?
I think the serenity prayer brings us into that middle, standing in the middle of it with some stability and strength.
I love it. Just a thought.
Very nice. Have you memorized it?
Not yet. I'm working on it.
Great. Anybody memorize it? You want to say it? Would you mind?
No, my mind will probably go blank. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Nice. Thank you. So there's a question in the back, comment, all in the back corner.
I was wondering about the middle way between, I guess you referred to it as like sensual pleasure and dharmic pleasure, or sensual pleasure and asceticism. So rejecting asceticism, I mean, that could come pretty naturally, that I don't want to reject certain things that I like. I think that's something that I struggle with, is I'm not sure where to draw the line with sensual pleasure. So obviously, you know, you have something like drug or alcohol addiction that might feel good in the moment.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear that that is worth rejecting. Or, I don't know, if I bought a new bicycle and I'm excited about riding it, like at what point do I say that's too much like sensual pleasure that I'm attached to? Like I'm not sure where to recognize that harm.
Yeah, great. I think that there's two ways I can think of. One of them involves your own mindfulness, where you pay attention to the consequence. So if you love riding your bike so much that you're riding it a lot, but you know, after a few weeks, your boss calls you and says, "You know, we haven't seen you at work for a few." You know, you realize probably there's a problem, unless you're ready to give up your job. So I mean, you can look at the consequences. So if you're riding your bike so much that you're always tired now because you ride into the evening, you might be addicted to something. So look at the consequences and see, you know, is your life better off from riding a bike and enjoying it? Are you refreshed and renewed and delighted to be alive? And you want to go for, you know, you're happier to go to work because of it? Or just somehow is it detrimental to you? Do you overdo it, or you're so addicted to it, that so attached to it, that when it's a rainy day, you snap at everyone you see because you can't get on your bike. And well, then maybe you have a little issue. So you have to look at the consequences. So that's the one way to do it. And but if it's beneficial, it could be. Sometimes these pleasures are actually beneficial for us. And please do it. The other is, because sometimes we're not the best judge of these things, maybe you have friends who will let you know. You know, that bicycle, you're not the same since you got it. You know, and so, really? Tell me. Is that okay? Is that an answer that's satisfying enough?
Yeah, I think so.
Great, thank you. Okay, one more question. Yeah. Or comment.
So you mentioned about sometimes you don't want to be like too aloof. You have to find the middle between being like lost and then also being distant. And I feel like I often had thought like, oh, I need to like step back and be mindful and stuff. And so it's, I guess, can you speak more about how you balance, like, oh, I want to be in the moment, but, like, sometimes when I am in the moment, I lose track of, like, mindfulness and stuff.
I see. So you get, when you're in the moment, you're so absorbed in what you're doing that you're not really present for what's happening in some mindful way?
Yeah.
Well, the fact that you know it that well, it seems like you know that this happens to you.
Yeah.
That's the middle way. To know that's happening. And then take that into account. So the next time you're going to do the same thing, so there's a danger that I'm going to get so absorbed, I'm not really in touch with what's happening here, that maybe I should enter the situation differently.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I feel like the only counter I've found like so far in my life is like stepping back more and being more aloof, which I feel like I thought up till now that maybe that was the right way to do it. But after you said that, I think that there's definitely like some ground in between that I...
Absolutely, yeah. I would write that. I wouldn't pull back too far. I'd pull back just enough so you can find that middle place of knowing and then go back in. See if you can bring the knowing with you. And then as soon as the knowing disappears, then pull back. And kind of ride that edge, and the knowing will get stronger and stronger. And one of the ways to help that is to develop develop as a natural, kind of second nature kind of thing, habit, mindfulness of the body. So you find yourself after a while that you're always kind of... connected to your body, awake in your body, aware of your body, and your body will help you stay present in a way that makes it easier for the mind to do so as well.
Thank you. Yeah, that was helpful.
Great. So thank you very much. It's wonderful to have you here, and we've had so few people coming, and it's so nice to get more people and just kind of... It turns out people are pretty wonderful. So thank you for being here.